Hi, I'm Andrew.
And I'm Tim, and this is Get On Board,
a podcast about games worth playing.
Welcome to Get On Board, a podcast about games worth playing. I'm Tim, your old host.
And I'm Andrew, your new host.
That's actually not the right antonym.
Young. Yeah. Gotcha. Moving on.
Although experience is a better word for me. But anyway, okay. Not to say that you're inexperienced. All right. Today, we've got a couple of cool things on board. The first one is a pick five, where we just pick five games that match an interesting topic. Today's topic is, well, that was different.
Games that you picked up off the store shelf virtually, if necessary, and flipped over because they have that one thing in them that's just really interesting and unique.
Or you went to play them and, wow, it just did something different that you kind of didn't expect and maybe wish more games did. So, yeah, it's just a kind of a pick five about things that struck us as different and interesting about games.
And full disclosure here, not all of my picks were successful at what they set out to do.
How so?
As in, they may have been very ambitious without necessarily hitting the perfect form of whatever that mechanic is or whatever that theme was or what have you.
Right.
So some of these games, I feel like I'm rewarding for what they set out to do. They're just audacious in what they try to do.
Okay.
Without them necessarily being the perfect game.
Right,
maybe
right,
I'm
right.
saying I want to see a 2.0 of this.
Right. I'm the same way. There are a couple of games on my list that I would say is not a game that I would really recommend people buy. Mm-hmm. But I really respect it for what it tried to do. Mm-hmm. It was pretty amazing. And the other thing that I would say as a disclaimer is this is totally based on our experience. I mean,
sure.
I'm not claiming that there are not other games out there. In fact, I would really be interested in if any of our listeners hear me talk about one of these interesting mechanics, I would really be interested in knowing if there are other games that do similar things.
Yeah.
Because that would really be cool for me to find some of those. So let's begin. Andrew, what's at the top of your pick five?
The top of my pick five, I would sing it, but I can't remember how the song goes. Do Not Forsake Me, Oh My Darling by Todd Sanders.
Me, oh My Darling.
There you go. This is a solo game of high adventure in space.
In space?
In space.
Oh, okay.
So it's a space western. You captain the Do Not Forsake Me, Oh My Darling, which has to win the award for longest ship name ever. And holy cow, what's innovative about this game on the one hand is if you're not in the solo scene or the print and play scene, you may not be aware of this, but there are a lot of designers out there on Board Game Geek designing entire games in only 18 and sometimes even 9 cards. So this game has 18 cards, including the rules.
So the cards multi-use? Is that how he gets away with it? Or
are they multi-use? Oh, these are the most multi-use cards I have ever seen. So here's what you're going to be doing. You are going to be exploring the Rim Quadrants. You are going to be searching for pirates and criminals, bringing them to justice and collecting credits.
Okay.
There's a map. There are enemy ships. There are rules for combat in 18 cards.
So let's see. Glory to Rum, you can kind of flip the card on each end. So like, do you hold these three-dimensionally at different angles?
Okay, so there's one aspect I want to talk about here.
Okay.
And honestly, this is a game where it's packed so compactly that it hurts itself. It would benefit from more size, and he has released an expansion, actually. This came out in 2015. He released an expansion in 2016. But the most impressive part is a mechanic called the RSF method.
Okay.
Which is how he accomplishes die rolls with cards. So RSF stands for Rotate, Shuffle, Flip. Every card is double-sided, and each corner of it has a different die face.
Okay.
So to resolve encounters, you'll have your ship, and then you'll have the enemy ship that you're combating. Ships are another thing on the multi-use part of the cards. And to resolve combat, what you'll do is this RSF mechanic. So you will first rotate the top 50% of the deck so that you flipped the die faces. Then you'll shuffle the deck. Then you'll flip the bottom 9 cards over. So you're kind of just shuffling the deck more thoroughly because it's such a small deck. So you'll rotate, shuffle, flip. Then you'll pick the bottom card from the deck because they're double-sided. And the die value that's showing on that card will be the die value that you just rolled.
Rotate, shuffle, flip, pull the bottom card, and that's the die value.
So this is innovative. Wow. This is really innovative, and I love the portability of it. In practice, it can be a little bit cumbersome, especially when you're in a combat and you have to resolve a bunch of die rolls. You have to do that maneuver for each one or each couple ones, I believe. So it's not a perfect game, but this is pretty much a 4X game in a 18-card format. It's very ambitious. It's incredibly ambitious. And I no longer have this game. I print and played it at one time. I might come back to it. I never got around to the expansion. I might come back to this because it is just, this is easily the most audacious game on this list for me.
You know, it's interesting. When I think of audacious games, I often think of things that are huge and sprawling, like Zaya, Legends of Adrift system, right? But it's interesting to think that there are designers on the other end saying, small can I get this game and make an incredible game out of it? And
absolutely.
If anybody's going to explore that, well, it would be you. So, no, these are things that like interest me, but I guess not enough to really.
Well, what's crazy is Todd Sanders set out to say, what if I could make a game that produces some of the thrills that Zaya produces with 18 cards?
Interesting.
That's pretty audacious. And that interests me because I can't play Zaya all the time. I can play this one. It's a lot more accessible. So it's almost more audacious because I could bring it out way more often.
No, but that's cool. That's really interesting. And okay. Hey, boy.
You're not sounding convinced, but you're sounding like your mind is being broadened.
You're pulling me that way a little bit. If I was going to print one off, that might be it. This is a print and play, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Free.
Interesting.
Yep.
All right. Well, the first one I'm going to bring up then is audacious, but in a very different way.
Of course.
Gollum Arcana.
Now, it's a game
precious,
probably,
like that kind of Gollum?
Yeah, not quite.
These golems that are like these huge monsters that little people pilot, or that at least they look little when they're inside these enormous monsters. This game was a miniatures war game. The miniatures came pre-painted with incredible detail. And the audacious thing that this game tried to do was be fully app integrated.
Mm-hmm. Now,
I don't think that Gollum Arcana is the first game to do app integration. Mm-hmm. Actually, I don't know offhand. It might have been nice if before the podcast I'd done a little research on this. I do think that, if I remember right, Alchemists by Chet Games had come out before that. Not sure if XCOM had come out before Gollum Arcana, although Gollum Arcana may have been in research. I don't know how long when the inception of the idea was. But in any case, Gollum Arcana... You set out these tiles and you place your guys on these opening spaces. You pull up your apps. You show where your guys are going to be placed. You know, if you're playing a two-player game, it's better if each of you has a tablet. Each of you has this like little pen where you can kind of point to the guy, point to the location where you want to go to, and it's going to tell you how many movement points that's going to cost you. And if there's a guy there, it's going to like do the attack and, you know, basically figure out all the math based on the character stats and within terrain and everything. So it's like a miniatures game.
I'm sensing the problem with this, though.
That does all the thinking for you.
You can just do it all on the app.
That was kind of the issue.
Mm.
It is so ambitious. It was such a labor of love. And the miniatures look incredible.
Yeah, and let's clarify. When he says miniatures, he means like 3 inches. I mean,
these things are ridiculous. And the colossi
are like these enormous, like 9-10 inch tall things.
Oh my word.
And right now, I mean, I guess I'll say it because it's not like it can hurt the, I believe the designer publisher went bankrupt at this point. Pulled everything. Yes, people worry about app support. That's a valid concern, but it's still on the app store. I think it's been handed around. The source code's been handed around a bit to people who promise that they're going to work on it, kind of keep it going, or at least keep it current with the latest OSs or whatever. Yes, definitely it's a game where you should be a little bit speculative about buying it. But I would say the miniatures are so cool. I have a whole shelf full of them. I've pulled it down a few times to play it. It's like one of those collector's items that like in 10, 15 years, I'll be showing people, hey, look, guys, this is like the first attempt at this kind of a game. But you're absolutely right. The problem with the game was And it was, even when my son and I played it, we just felt like we were playing a video game and just kind of moving characters along with it. There was just something about the way the app integration was done that sort of took some of the fun out of the game.
Yeah.
But I still commend it. And I really feel for the people who had put so much work into this thing. It was such a labor of love.
Yeah.
Gollum Arcana.
Well, my next one is Fast Forward, the Fast Forward series, but specifically Fortress, which is the only one I've played. This one came out last year. It's by Freedom and Freeze, which means it's green, and of course starts with the letter F.
There you go.
I'd mention 504 if I had played it as another wildly ambitious game, but I'll settle for another Freedom and Freeze game. The Fast Forward games have no rules. You just start drawing cards from the top of the deck, and as you draw, rules cards will pop up and just kind of reveal themselves, and all of a sudden you're playing a game. I get what they're going for here. The idea is that you have a game with very little setup time. You have a game that casual gamers can pick up and just play.
Mm-hmm.
But in my plays of it, and we didn't get all the way through the game, it doesn't play good with two, so I was playing it with Alicia, and in my plays of it, I think the flexibility they gained from doing that, there were still some significant trade-offs that they had to reckon with. I could see this working really well. Actually, Fog of Love does this for a far more complex game. You just set up the game, and the decks that come from the manufacturer are pre-seeded so that as you start doing stuff, there's kind of like a tutorial in the deck. This is a little different. This is the entire rule book, is these little cards. So there's a couple problems with this. One is it's hard to read the cards from around the table.
Okay.
And when you start out, you're literally just drawing cards. You draw some stuff and you don't know what it does. So instead of being accessible, it's just boring. I mean,
okay, but just for our listeners, because I will bet that I thought of this the first time I heard of this game. Mm-hmm. But some of our listeners are probably thinking this sounds like Flux.
It's not Flux. It's not Flux because not every card changes the rules. It's not like the rules change by what people play. It's just that the cards have been ordered in such a way that as you play, new rules are revealed in the draw deck. So the draw deck comes in a certain order.
Okay.
So that maybe one player draws a new minion and the very next card is a rules card explaining how minions work. So when you draw a rules card, that's not your turn. You just place it in the middle, you all read it, and then you draw a card. So the very first rule is just draw a card.
Doesn't it become, though, kind of predictable? Are there the same rules revealed in the same order every time?
Well, the idea is it's a continuous game. So you play, I think, 16 or 17 games of it. And by the end, you're playing the full rule set. At that point, ostensibly, you have a totally replayable game that you can keep playing with the full rules that you can teach to anyone. And you can teach anyone at any point. They can come in at any point. So I see the value of this. I really commend them for trying it. In practice, Fortress just wasn't that interesting. We got three or four plays in. I know I didn't give it a fair shot. This is not a review. I didn't play the whole thing. But I love this system of teaching rules. I think if you iron the kinks out, it could be really valuable.
Right.
So I wanted to commend it for that. It was one of the first to do this kind of learn as you play. And now we're actually seeing other games pick it up, which is the whole reason we made this list. So awesome.
And just kind of a quick aside too, there is something we kept off this list that we're going to keep for another pick five. And that is games that did something new that ended up sort of changing the game.
Gaming.
Changing gaming, really.
Yeah.
We tried to kind of shy away from those.
Right.
If anything, we're trying to pick some things that we hope will become
more of a thing.
Yeah, more of a thing.
Yeah.
Get picked up and improved on.
Yeah.
So second on my list is Galaxy Trucker, a game that I hardly ever play. A game that I think has one of the worst rule books ever written. Oh my goodness. It's really not that complicated.
A lot of people love that
of a
rule
game.
Book.
Oh, I don't. I don't mind rule books that do that thing. It's just that it did it in a very convoluted way. Mm. Of course, the thing I'm referring to is you kind of play sort of like this lighter, more basic game, and then more rules are introduced as you go along. But there was no one good place for like the entire rule repository. That part was not well written.
Right.
And so it was just too difficult to find. And I ended up, actually, one of the reasons I bought the app was just to learn the rules.
Right.
And I was like, oh, yeah, now I get it. Now it's clear.
Yeah.
So, but Galaxy Trucker has this phase that everybody raves about, that little Tetris phase at the beginning where you're timed, you're flipping over the sand timer, you have rules that you can only grab with one hand, and there are rules about how the pieces connect together, and you're trying to build a ship that balances all these concerns like cargo pods and engines and weaponry and batteries to power the weaponry and the engines, and it's really kind of a difficult puzzle to solve. And of course, if you're trying to be first, you could build a small ship and flip the timer.
Right.
But you're giving the guy across from you more time then to put together something better than what you have. Or maybe you're pressuring him into making a mistake.
Right.
So it's really kind of cool. That part just is so amazing. And then you get ready to fly those ships, and it's just this random luck fest of draw the top card, see what happens. And I know listeners may tell me that, yeah, but you're allowed to look at those cards if you have time in the building phase. Who does? That has never happened in a single game that I've played. And even if you do, it's sort of like, I don't know, you hit the meteor shower and you roll the dice and, oh, it hit your ship at that vulnerable point that you couldn't quite cover. And ha ha, funny, funny, funny. And it's kind of fun, I guess, in a really random way. But I wish that first part would get incorporated in more games. Mm. That part is so fun.
The real-time aspect.
Right. I mean, it would be more fun to play that game, to play that first part of the game, and then score the ship on its ability.
Yeah.
Or find some other way to test the ship than what they did for the rest of the game. But it reminds me, actually, of an old video game. Maybe some of our listeners will remember Rampart. It was in the arcade years ago, and it was popular on the Sega Genesis and Super Nintendo and Nintendo.
This is where it becomes very clear that I'm your young host, ladies and gentlemen.
Oh, yeah. See, I get to show some old guy knowledge here. Okay. Yeah, this is like you got all these little Tetris pieces, and you had to surround a castle and land, and you had to surround it perfectly by placing, and you would get this weird-shaped castle. But the bigger area that you could cover, the more cannons you would get, and then you would fire the cannons and destroy each other's stuff.
Okay.
In fact, if you could make a board game version of that, that would be absolutely amazing. And I think this first phase would be a great part to that, Rampart the board game. So for all I know, it's been tried, but...
Put on your game designer hat.
Yep. Yeah. So that's mine, Galaxy Trucker.
Okay, so here's a quick informal poll. Mm-hmm. How do you react when I say educational games?
Oh, I'm sorry.
Okay, yeah, okay. I react the same way. Mm-hmm. And I think you know what I'm going to bring up here. To be blunt, I did not know that teaching games could be this good. I mean, this game, Kaleika, I play just as a game. Also happens to teach you a whole bunch about...
Wait, this is the Polish...
Yeah.
Soviet one?
This is the Polish one, teaches you about what things were like in the Soviet Union.
Okay,
supply
but that's not
shortages.
Really an educational game.
Okay.
Though. I mean, you do get some educational
you say that,
value from it.
But this game was produced by the National Institute of History in Poland.
That's true.
And it was issued to Polish schools, and it was banned in Russia. So they're doing something right. Okay? They're doing something right. If you want to contest the facts in this game, banning the game is not the best way to contest this game. Anyways, that's neither here nor there. Kaleika is just a fun, manipulative game about standing in line. That sounds so boring, but it's this 30-minute little mess with the lines to try to get the deliveries to the stores that you need to fill your shopping list so that you can get the goods that you need, and you're sending your family members to go stand at these different stores and wait for these goods to come.
Yeah.
Great teaching tool, and also happens to be just a really fun game. The same designer has released now Across the Iron Curtain, which talks about fleeing East Germany, and I'm interested...
Wow.
This designer, I've only played Kaleika, but he's also released historical Polish war games. I mean, who is designing those? Very, very ambitious. This is Kaleika by Karol Madaj. It came out in 2011, and I think Across the Iron Curtain is coming out this year or just came out last year.
Mm-hmm.
So props to you, Karol, for producing teaching games that don't stink.
Yeah, it's interesting. I just watched Bridge of Spies, so this is a little bit thematic for me.
Good movie.
Yeah, let's say something a little bit serious, too. It's interesting that here we are, thinking about our lives in terms of, can we save up for a better car, or what board games should we purge off our shelves? And people back in this day were just trying to get enough groceries to feed the family.
That's true.
So I guess if a game can help put you in touch with more of that, then good on it. So earlier you mentioned that there was a game you weren't going to mention because you hadn't played it yet. I'm going to mention a game I haven't played yet. Okay. I know it kind of breaks the rules.
Shame on you.
It's a game I've watched playthroughs of. I've listened to a lot of reviews of it. No, I haven't basically played it. But I really respect what it does.
Okay.
And it's Millennium Blades. The reason I haven't bought this, guys, and I believe it's Level 99 Games, the same people that make the Battlecon system.
This is the one about building your own... collectible card game, isn't it?
Right. It's managing. So the game is called Millennium Blades, and it's about a collectible card game called Millennium Blades. But this is not a parody. This really ends up being an excellent simulation. From what I can see, it looks absolutely amazing in terms of the fact that you're doing all of these actions and you're sort of living in this world, sort of figuring out how to afford the best cards on the market, and then you of course go into tournaments and you buy like booster packs that aren't really booster packs, but like booster packs are sort of randomly pre-made within the game,
right,
to boost your deck that you're going to take to a tournament, which would then give you better positioning to get even more cards if you end up doing well in, and that kind of thing. And that idea that you actually create a game simulation, this is the first successful one that I've seen out there. Yeah, you have those parody ones, you know, that we always laugh at. Just about every episode we bring them up. So
it's becoming a requirement.
Yeah. I suppose if this is somebody's first episode, we should say one of them anyway. Like what?
Deck building. The deck building game.
The deck building game about building decks on houses. Yes, things like that. But see, this is what this is exactly what Millennium Blades is not. And it's given that incredible treatment that Level 99 gives all their games, which is we're going to give you like so much game in this box that you're going to have replayability on this thing for years to come.
Right.
And yeah, they release new sets and new packs for it, but it's not in the actual CCG model. It's
right,
you know, kind of more like an LCG or expansion model.
Interesting critique of their own industry.
But I just really respect Level 99 for this kind of simulation and for doing the first one. I think that I can think of that has been really successful, at least a simulation about gaming.
Props to them.
That's one that I'm really looking forward to playing Millennium Blades.
Okay, well, in the interest of letting our listeners behind the curtain, I'm going to reveal that the game that I'm about to feature, I played today, and not just today, but about 15 minutes ago before we started reviewing.
We played today.
Before we started recording this. Yes, I am talking about Sofrenito, the dexterity worker placement game about building recipes. This game, okay. This game gets so much right, so much that I want to talk about here. The main thing I want to talk about is the fact that this is a dexterity game that does it right. There's these giant zones on the board where you can go to buy spice cards, and you will accomplish that by chucking these little poker chips, these clacky little poker chips, on the board. And not only that, but these poker chips have numbers, which you can then use to control how expensive those spices will be for you, how much other people can sell them for. So there's thought to which chip you even choose to flick. But then, of course, there's the chucking part, which is unpredictable, and you can knock other people's stuff out. And there's extra special action spaces that let you do stuff. And this is all accomplished with a dual layer board. So there's actually two layers of chipboard on this board. There's an outer frame, and then there's this central just arena that these chips can kind of bounce in. And wow.
Okay, but you got to leave something for the review.
Okay, yeah, that's true. We are planning on reviewing
so
this one.
Tell me, though, what is the new and innovative thing? Like, what's that new thing that catches you about this game?
The new and innovative thing that catches me is the strategy behind the dexterity.
Yeah.
I mean, compare it to something like Flick 'em Up or Pitch Car or something. You know, there's just more thought here. It is worker placement, y'all. It's worker placement with poker chips. You just happen to be chucking the poker chips onto the board. it's still a worker placement.
Chuck, you don't.
You do chuck. Yes. So you have to kind of throw them, and there's a couple rules for throwing, but it's simple. It's fun. There's a little hole in the middle of the chip, so you can see if you're on a space or not. I love this. Oh, super great.
For the life of me, I can't understand. I'm kind of bleeding into your.
We both played it, so
your list here, but I can't understand why this game isn't more popular. You know me, I'm AP prone.
Right.
And people were waiting for me a little
you,
bit.
You were AP prone about this game, which I didn't think was possible.
It really gives you interesting decisions to make.
No, it does. Absolutely.
It's like you're wondering because the underside of the card. See, I don't think I've seen a flipping game where the chip you throw matters in anything more than its placement.
Right.
This matters in terms of its value.
Right.
Which is hidden, yeah. Unless you accidentally threw it towards flipped it the wrong way.
I did a couple times.
But it's hidden. And so it's sort of like, okay, I want to buy this card, so I'm going to throw my chip on the circle that'll let me buy this spice card. But, man, there's another guy already there. Was he trying to buy it, or was he trying to sell it out of his hand?
Mm-hmm.
What number chip did he throw out there? Do I need to beat it so that I'll have the first shot at buying it, or do I just need to accent it a little bit so I have a better shot? You know, so it's really –
interesting.
Really fascinating decisions that you're making.
Yep.
In a flicking game.
In a flicking game.
Or a chucking game or whatever we might call this, but in a dexterity game.
Dexterity game.
There you go.
Dexterity game. So that's my number four. Saffronito, which is published by Zoxumspielen.
Wow.
I am butchering that. And it is just a great game.
Yeah, I think we've just effectively been a really good advertisement for the one person that has it out here on the geek market to sell. But
we got you, Bob 220.
Man, yeah, this is a game that designers, if you're designing a dexterity game, please look at this game.
Come over to my house and play it. I'm not selling my copy.
It's just amazing. Okay, this is one that I brought up before, but the mechanic is so innovative that I really want to bring it up again. And I am pretty much begging any designer out there to incorporate this economy mechanic in their game. This is from Lord of the Rings, the deck building. Sorry, not the deck building.
That's the one that you ranted about.
No, yeah, that's one I ranted about last week. Lord of the Rings, the trading card game, which has been out of print. It was by Decipher. I think Decipher is not even... Actually, I'm not even sure if they were going concern. Lord of the Rings, the trading card game, had this really interesting economy mechanic where the player who is playing the Fellowship is up against the player who's playing the shadow side. The Fellowship player has cards to put out. How does he pay the costs? He simply puts the card out and gets the tokens from the supply and puts them out in the center. So in essence, he has unlimited economy to put characters and their weapons. He can build this enormous Fellowship on his first turn. Only problem, he's going to leave all this money on the table, because everything that he puts on the table from the supply is what the shadow player gets to use to buy the minions and their weapons and their spells.
Interesting.
And all of those things to fight against him. So
that's fair.
It's incredibly fair.
Yeah.
And it was one of the most, because he didn't have to commit a lot of cards. Yeah, there were some cards that sort of like let you adjust the values that went in and out. But for the most part, most TCG, LCGs I've played, your economy engine is a big thing.
Right.
And if you don't build it right, or if you don't get the right cards toward the beginning of the game, you can really get hosed.
Right.
But this game just had this perfect tit-for-tat sort of mechanic.
Yeah.
And very often the Fellowship player would hold stuff back because he thinks, man, there is no way. I'm up against a swarm deck. He's going to end up swarming and get three characters on my Frodo, and I'm going to die. Mm-hmm. So I've got to hold back a little bit here. I've got to exercise a little bit of restraint. That was just brilliant. And I wish more games would take this approach to the competing economies of both players, especially TCGs and LCGs.
Mm.
So
very cool. Well, my last pick is Vast the Crystal Caverns by Patrick Leader. Two words: real asymmetry. This game is four different games in one.
I'm pausing at your claim of real asymmetry, because a lot of what is called asymmetrical
is variable player powers.
Right.
Sometimes drastic, but no. In Vast, you are literally playing different games.
Yeah.
All four of you are playing different games. Your player board is your game, and it is different for each one of you. Now, there are a couple common threads. The dragon has to manage cards in a similar way to the cave managing omen tokens. Then the knight is a worker placement game, and the goblin is this resource management game and a fixed economy of card draw, and he has to manage secrets and monsters and lurk in the shadows. Everything, your win goals are asymmetrical, your turn order is asymmetrical, what you're doing is asymmetrical.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. Now, the only, well, the
are,
main...
Are the win, so the win conditions are different?
The win conditions are different. The cave wants to collapse on everyone. The knight wants to kill the dragon. The dragon wants to escape the cave. The goblins want to kill the knight.
What about the mechanics of what you're doing?
Totally different.
So it's not like you're drawing cards, playing cards.
No, you have different components.
Oh, that's
you
cool.
All have different components.
Oh, that's cool.
I'm telling you, man, come over on Thursday and play it.
Man.
We've played this one 5 times now, and here's the main problem, even though it's innovative. It's not accessible. It's just not, okay? You're not going to get into this game just easy breezy lemon squeezy. You're going to have to do some serious rules learning. Your first game's going to be a slog. It's going to take some time. The rules are not perfect nor polished. The asymmetry comes at a cost, but this game is radically different than anything else I've played. I'm really interested to try out Root, which is, it was just on Kickstarter by Cold Whirl. He's also done Pax Pamir and An Infamous Traffic. It's also from Leader Games, so I think it might be the 2.0 that this game needs to really push it in there. Or maybe the asymmetry just needs a certain lack of accessibility by default. I don't know. But wow, my mind was blown when I played Vast, and it's still blown just because of how ambitious that totally different player roles mechanic just fleshed itself out.
In 5 years, we're going to be looking back at Vast saying, hey, it was the game that inspired
X game.
That game.
Right.
That did it super well.
Yeah.
But does it have the potential to be that game itself?
I don't think so. I really enjoy it. Like I said, I scheduled a night on Thursday to play just Vast. It's one of those games that has that pull. And I'm still playing it. That'll be my 6th play, which for a 2.5 hour game is not insignificant. I enjoy it, but I agree. I think this will be the building blocks that some other game will come along and really just take those in a way where we all say, of course, why didn't we notice this before?
Yeah.
Vast deserves credit for being the trailblazer in this regard.
Well, the last one on my list is a game that I've played 3 times and barely understand. And I'll say right up front, it's like it's that whacked out concept album kind of game that it's incredible, it's not accessible,
right?
But I'm really hoping that it spawns a series of games or other designers to or inspires other designers to do similar things, and that's Tragedy Looper.
Oh, I really want to play this one.
Well, what's really cool about this game, If I were to describe it to you, you might think that it was like Clue. It's okay, it's not. It does have this sort of deduction element in it where you're trying to deduct. Okay, the basic plot of the game is that you're part of a team of time travelers.
Right.
You get a limited number of loops to go back in time. You know that something bad has happened. You don't even know what it is. You don't even know who it happened to. You just see the disturbance. And the thing is that because of the rules of time, which clearly we all know, I mean,
obviously,
clearly you know that time rules restrict you from talking to other time people.
Oh, yeah. I learned that in time kindergarten.
Right. When you go back in time to solve mysteries. Okay. So you're not allowed. You can talk all you want during the part where you're in now time.
Mm-hmm.
But then when you loop back, you're not allowed to talk at all. Mm-hmm. And there's a game master who is like the evil mastermind. He knows what the main plot is, the subplot is, the roles of all the players, what the incident is. And he's laying cards out there on this on these locations, and so are the protagonists. And at the end, we're sort of flipping up the cards and seeing if you guessed
well, you might see that a murder occurred, and based on some of the clues and what some of the characters did, you might divine what the main plot of this thing is, or what the subplot is, or who is playing some of the roles, but you don't know this for sure, usually the first time out. It becomes clear the second time. It becomes clear the third time, but clear enough that you were able to guess enough to win the game. And that's, it's really, it's a complicated beast.
This is making my head hurt.
Oh, it, well, and I am doing I'm explaining it in a very, very elementary fashion. It is, this game will give you a headache, but it's so ambitious, so audacious, and it is the smartest of these kinds of deduction games I have ever played. And
how does this compare to something like Time Stories, which I understand came out 4 years later? I'm not contesting the innovative part. I'm just wondering, does Time Stories take some of that initial genius and make it a little more accessible, smooth it out?
And this is where I'll go back to the disclaimer. I have not played Time Stories.
Okay, fair enough.
Time Stories kind of makes me cringe a little bit because of the sort of cost of each expansion.
Yeah,
and the lack of replayability. This one, too, it does have limited playability in terms of there are only so many scenarios here, but there are so many fan-made scenarios online, and it's not difficult as GM to kind of make your own scenarios for this too.
It's kind of a cross between Time Stories and Sherlock Holmes Consulting Detective.
I'm
not doing it justice.
I knew that that comparison would come up.
Yeah.
It really is a different game from Sherlock Holmes Consulting Detective. You do not have near the informational resources that you do in that kind of a game.
Okay.
So,
well, you've made me want to play it. So,
I'll spend another few hours rereading the rules and we can give it a shot.
Fair enough.
So, all right.
Fair enough.
So those are our pick fives for games that on the theme of, well, that was different. Boy, it feels icy in here. Man, it also feels like this podcast has really invested a lot of money in some quality sound effects.
Yeah.
So
that was Industrial Light and Magic right there.
I'll tell you.
We are going to be talking about
The Arctic Monkeys. Heck yeah.
A game by Robert K. Gabhart. Published in 2009. Called not Arctic Monkeys, but
Arctic Scavengers.
Arctic Scavengers.
Oh, sorry, mispronounced. Scavengers.
Scavengers. That's how the British say it. Anyways, Arctic Scavengers is a deck builder.
Andrew?
My favorite type of game. Wow. I don't know about Tim.
Wow. So you're going to give this a bad review?
Arctic Scavengers is a deck builder.
Or do I have to wait to see?
In which you are trying to assemble the largest tribe of people in a post-apocalyptic wasteland. So this will test your skills as a leader to rejoin and inspire humanity. And you will do this by hiring mercenaries from a Dominion-style marketplace. So with lots of different types of cards available for purchase.
Yep.
Digging for treasure in the frozen junk pile and battling for valuable resources and tribal families who are worth a lot of points in the contested resources stack. After 17 turns, the game is over. And the person who has accumulated the most tribe members, so each card will count as one or more people in your tribe, the person who has accumulated the most tribe members wins the game.
Now that's 17 turns for each player, right? There's, or is that
17 rounds of everyone taking a turn? Yeah.
Right. So there are 17 contested resources.
There are 14 contested resources.
Oh, sorry, and
the first three you're just kind of ramping up.
Right. And so that contested resource stack plus three is what is the timer game timer. For the game.
Right. Which, let's jump right into the magic here. Contested resources pile. Genius!
Oh, absolutely.
That's what it says in my show notes here. Okay, let's talk about a mechanic that games are not copying. Okay, so the contested resources stack is a stack of really good point cards, either tribal families that are worth up to 5 points, or really good weapons like the grenade that buffs up your fight actions. And every round, you will be able to set aside a certain number of cards from your hand to fight with. And when you fight, you will compare your total fight value on the cards that you set aside with all the other players. Whoever has the highest value wins the contested resource for that round.
And here's the delicious angst that's involved in that.
Oh, man.
Is every one of those cards that you're setting aside to fight at the end of your turn, you might have used to buy other tribe members.
Right.
Or to get them to join your right. clan. To buy other goods. To go into the junk pile and pull out something useful from the junk pile.
Yep.
But the player whose turn it is gets to look at that contested resource, peek at it, put it down. Nobody else knows what it is.
Yep.
We don't know whether it's kind of like an okay resource. We don't know if the two cards he kind of kept back were two cards because he didn't really have anything left over to do anyway, or if they're two right. power cards that give five fight between them, or a power card and a sniper. You have no idea.
This provokes so much bluffing and competition. It takes everything that's bad about Dominion and throws it out the window. It gives you interaction. It makes you care about what the other players are doing. It makes you try mm-hmm. to read their faces and see, okay, is that five brawlers for a total of 15 fight, or is that five refugees for a total of zero fight? He's got five cards. That could be a lot of fight, or that could be no fight, or he could even throw in a nasty card like a sniper or a saboteur that will disarm part of your fighting crew. Wow. I love this mechanic.
And if you have ever played games like Android Netrunner, where you're the corporation and you just put something in your server and that runner is trying to figure out whether it's an asset or an agenda that's valuable or whether it's a trap. Or if you've ever played games like Devastation of Indines or Yomi, where you're both ready to set down the card and is he going to play the card that he thinks I think he's going to play, mm-hmm. or did he think that mm-hmm. I think that he was going to play that card? If you've ever played those kinds of games, or even poker, you will like this part of it. It's so yeah. welcome in this game.
No,
and it's thematic.
Perfect. It's perfect. Quinn's from Shut Up and Sit Down said, deck building should be a mechanic, not that games hang their hat on, but that they then go on to do something really interesting with.
Right.
And this is a game that does that. It takes that base deck building mechanic, which, let's be honest, by now everyone has played, okay, and throws on just that meat that makes you come back to it.
I hadn't planned on doing this, but I'm going to make another comparison to Android Netrunner.
Okay.
The beauty of Android Netrunner is everything you do with the cards feels thematic.
Mm-hmm.
Whether you're a runner building up your rig or a corporation laying ice in front of your servers,
mm-hmm.
everything you do in that game feels thematic, and that is the main magic to me of this game. Everything mm-hmm. that we're going to describe to you can fall under the heading of thematic,
yeah.
thematic, thematic.
Yeah.
They did it with a deck builder, and it's just beautiful.
And let's just say, I do not like post-apocalyptic games. I hate zombie games. I don't even like deck builders. And here I am playing a post-apocalyptic deck builder. Who would have thought? And sure, the theme is not my favorite, but I cannot lie. And the theme is very well integrated.
Right.
This is probably the most thematic deck builder I've played. And it's not even close. I mean, the theme is very well integrated for a deck builder. I definitely agree.
Think about the various actions you're that are on your people. You can, what is it? What do you call where you kind of dig through your pile? Scavenge, right?
Yeah.
So you play out these scavengers. Is that what you call them?
Mm-hmm.
And they let you sort of dig through your draw pile to draw a few more cards to see if you can find anything else that's good. You have food, which lets you buy food and medicine, which lets you buy other resources out there on the board.
Hire other mercenaries.
Right.
Right.
And some of those are good at fighting, so some of those are going to be really good in sort of that battle phase if you hold them back for battle, but some of them are better at healing or buying cards. Some of them are snipers, which will take
right.
out other people's fighters before they count for victory. So those are some of the actions. And the expansions, you have buildings that you can build that can assist you. But there's another thing that you do that just feels so incredibly thematic.
Mm-hmm.
This is what you do in a post-apocalyptic world. You send guys out on missions to scavenge for stuff in a junk pile.
Yeah.
And there's this big junk stack. And so, you only get to do this once per turn, but you play cards that have a certain number of shovels on them.
Right.
Depending on the shovel value, you can dig that many cards from the pile.
Mm-hmm.
And you can look at them and hopefully pull something good, or you might just get a bunch of junk in your hand
right.
that isn't worth anything. That, again, it just feels so thematic.
Absolutely. And you touched on this. One of my magics is you can only take one of each type of action per turn.
Right.
So you have the card draw action, you have the dig action, you have the food and medicine, which lets you hire other mercenaries,
mm-hmm.
and then you have the fight action. Four very simple actions. You can only do each of those once. So you could buff up your card draw to where you're drawing four cards. But if you draw a bunch of cards, they'll let you draw more cards. Too bad. You can't use them to draw cards again. You've right. already done your card draw action. Kind of like Dominion, you can buff up an action and do it multiple times. I can dig for five cards or something and keep one of those. But mm-hmm. then I can't dig a second time in that same turn. That feels thematic. It feels limiting. It feels refreshing. I find the endless chains in Dominion. So, okay, I've got one buy and then yeah. I buy this card, which gives me like two buy and what have you. And you just chain it and chain it and chain. That's exhausting. I don't care that much.
Yeah.
Okay. So to limit players to one each of these actions, but then give you the ability to, okay, this is the one time you're going to be able to draw cards. Are you going to draw one or are you going to buff it up and draw maybe three or four? That's right. an interesting decision. There's an opportunity cost to every card in your hand. And when a lot of deck builders, a poor deck builder makes it feel like, well, it doesn't matter what I draw. It's all luck of the draw. And it is what I get. These are multi-use cards. You can allocate a refugee to dig or to fight. You can allocate a brawler to fight or maybe to dig if you're desperate. They can right. do different things. And I find that really thematic. I find that really in keeping with the post-apocalyptic wasteland kind of theme.
I like deck builders too. Actually, there are only two that I can think of that do this. But Thunderstone and this deck builder give you items, but you have to have the people.
Yeah,
to attach like the items too.
I like that a lot.
Which give you another thing you have to kind of manage in your deck, the balance of people to items. And
yeah.
it's really frustrating when you hit a hand that's just all items, but you have nobody to blame usually but yourself for having gone a little bit overambitious on item purchases. But of course, if you find a lot of things in your hand that you don't really want, this is mitigated by...
Free culling.
Say it again.
Freak-ulling.
Freak-ulling? I thought it was free-culling.
Well, I said that the first time. And oh, okay. The second time I said freak-ulling.
Sorry.
Freak-ulling is a Canadian violin player who does not like to be confused with this action.
Holy cow, that was obscure. Okay. I love the fact that this game doesn't make you draw special cards that what you call cards later yeah. on. If you happen to get that card in your hand or if it happens to be in the discard pile at that time,
yeah.
but then the culling card itself doesn't do much. This game just says, look, if there's something you don't like, put it on the bottom of the junk pile, shuffle the junk pile at the end of this turn, and it's going right. to be there in the junk pile and somebody else might pick it up.
And... again, speaking as someone who doesn't like deck builders, I find the culling mechanism exhausting. I don't want to tune my deck. And Arctic mm-hmm. Scavengers kind of has, well, a scavenging feel to it. You want a bigger deck because, you know, if you play with some of the expansions, there's a card that will give you a bonus for having the most tools, for having the most medicine. That's in keeping with the theme. I want right. to squirrel away every tool because you never know. You know, you never know when it might be useful. Mm-hmm. But the fact that that free culling is there. So if you do want to tell your refugee, sorry, buddy, why don't you go out to the ice pile? We can't take care of you anymore. Wow, that bites.
Right.
But you can do it, you know.
But it'll cost you.
It'll cost you a point.
Because any person you throw there in that junk pile mm-hmm. is worth at least one population.
Yeah.
And that's the win condition.
People have value.
At the end.
Even in the Arctic.
Yeah, they do. Well done. Wow. That could be like the tagline for that game. People add value. Even
I don't know
the
if
Arctic.
That would help them sell more copies.
So, yeah. There is something else that's I think we alluded to already that I would put in the magic too. And... it's just the fact that this is a deck builder that in age of random markets chooses to have a common market. We've discussed yep. this in several other podcasts, but this is something I'm leaning more and more toward. The random market just has a lot of problems in yep. that, well, it's so random. and it's really difficult to formulate a decent strategy. And it's hard to build against, I mean, in a deck builder, the meta, there's no meta game. Prior to the game, it's being you're combating a strategy that player is building that turn.
Right.
Well, it's easier to combat that and easier to see what that is when you have that perfect information on the common market in front of you. So to me, that just takes a lot of the randomness. We talked yeah. about that in our randomness episode, a yeah. lot of the randomness out of deck building. Any other magic for you?
No, but I'm curious to know if you have a single tragic about this game.
I do.
Okay.
I have a couple.
Okay. Let's hear.
Over too soon. No, I'm not saying that like in a, that's actually kind of not a compliment.
What I love about this deck builder is that it doesn't drag on.
Yeah, but I think I'd like a more happy medium, especially maybe in a two-player game.
That could be. I could see it in a two-player. I wouldn't want it to go longer in a four-player. What I love about it is that the end is set from the beginning.
It's just another one of those games where you feel like you just built up your engine. But that may be... Actually, I have a question mark by this one.
I think that's the way you approach deck builders. Because I don't approach deck builders as, I'm going to build this really cool engine. I approach them as, I'm going to pick up every card that looks good and just kind of roll with it and see what happens. So I think that might be an approach thing.
Right. And I need to get used to the fact that if you buy a sniper and you only get to use him twice in the game, he served his purpose.
Yeah. And he's worth points also.
Yeah, right.
I mean...
So, but I need to get used to that fact. And that's okay.
Right.
In a game like this, that's okay.
Yeah.
It's probably more of a matter of personal taste. I would prefer the game to go a little bit longer than it does.
Well, mine is time-based as well.
Set up.
I don't want to pick through all the cards, especially if you get into the expansions. Oh, and add these... four cards to the junk pile, and then after you're done, be sure to separate them out because, well, what do you know? Those cards won't fit back in the junk slot unless you put the four cards from the expansion into the junk slot in the expansion slot. And look, the game is well organized. I appreciate that there are expansions in the box for replayability purposes. You're definitely getting your money's worth here. I think it's just inherent to deck builders. It's one of the things I don't like about them. I don't care that much to set up and tear down, and it's just a drag for a game that's so quick.
Yeah.
Now, to their credit, the one thing they do is instead of having just an unrestrained market, as you get further into the expansions, putting cards into the market will mean taking out other cards. So they do keep the market trim, and they do kind of provide their configurations that they would recommend. I appreciate that. I don't like the Dominion or Trains or any of those where it says, well, shuffle, you know, the 6,000 different types of cards you've got and draw 10.
Draw 10 random ones.
Yeah, I'm not about that. So I like that they have the intentionality here, but the setup time, it's a downer for me.
It is.
It's unavoidable, but it's there. So there you have it.
You know, I would say, too, on the downside a little bit, the artwork... I know what they were going for.
Mm-hmm.
They were going for just kind of like a grim, plain.
Yeah.
I did feel like the artwork could have been a little bit more vibrant, a little bit more visceral.
Yeah.
I mean, the sniper, I look at it, doesn't really like strike me as threatening or intimidating.
This is a game, though, where the graphic design is very good, even though the artwork is not. Now, hear what I'm saying. I'm not saying for thematic purposes. I'm saying for ease of use. The graphic design is great in terms of layout of the card and how to utilize the card. That's all very clear. So that's good. And when you tie that with the thematic feeling of the actions that you're doing, I'm willing to forgive the blot art because the theme still comes through to me and the graphic design is not an impediment. However, I see what you're saying, that it's not going to inspire anyone like Inish or Scythe or Glory to Rome or any of those gorgeous games that I love the look of. I get that, but it's solid. It's solid. It doesn't detract for me. And the other thing I would say is if you really hate deck builders, maybe try this one. I try this one. I enjoy it. I'd say this is probably the only deck builder I really like, with the exception of Eminent Domain, which is only half a deck builder. But if you really hate deck builders, if you really don't like them, this is still a deck builder.
Well, here at Get On Board, we really don't want to recommend a game unless we believe that it is a great game or is at least somebody's great game. And I don't mean the designer's grandmother or I mean that, you know. So I would say this. I would echo Andrew's caution here, that if you're not a fan of deck builders, you may still not find this to be a great game.
Right.
This may not be the deck builder that sways you, although it clearly swayed you.
It did.
But if you are a fan of deck builders and you have not given Arctic Scavengers a try, I really believe there's a great game under the hood of this thing. And
this is an excellent deck building game. It plays quickly. There's a lot of strategy there. It's got some unique twists on that base deck building formula, and there's tons of replayability in the box. So when I say I recommend this, I'm saying I'm looking at buying this in the future. This would be absolutely the next deck builder I buy, and it's on my wish list. And finally, Robert K. Gabhart, if your grandmother plays Arctic Scavengers, we want to know about it.
She would rock if she plays Arctic Scavengers.
I bet she would. So. I bet you have a great grandmother.
Okay. Recent plays.
Recent plays. I want to talk about Onitama, which I've actually played only on the app. I've been playing it on the app because I don't have a real life opponent and I'm terrible at it. So the AI still consistently beats me, especially when I'm distracted, as I often am when I'm playing it to fill time. But
give us the quick rundown of what Onitama is.
Yes. Brutally simplified overview. Onitama is played on a 5x5 grid. You have a master and four apprentices. There are two ways to win. The way of the stone, which is to capture the opponent's master, or the way of the stream, to place your master on the opponent's master's starting space. So it's a game of positioning and maneuverability. Here's what's brilliant about it. Out of a deck of 14, five movement cards are dealt out. And each time you move using one of those cards, there'll be things like the monkey, which is diagonal in any direction, or the dragon, which is leap forward two spaces or backward one. But the key thing about it is each time you use a movement card, you give that card to your opponent. And starting next turn, that will be a card that he can use. So there's only five different moves that can be made in the game. And each time you make a move, you're now giving your opponent the ability to make that move. Very thinky. Perfect as an app, I think.
Wow.
Because it's a lot quicker. The AI just plays, and I can kind of evaluate it.
Is the AI decent on the app? Not that we're here to review the app, but I'm curious.
I'm losing. Okay. So either the AI is decent or I'm terrible. Probably the latter. I beat the hardest AI about 40% of the time at this point.
Well, my recent play is Trois. Because why use three letters when
12 will
16
do.
Will do? So, okay, to be fair, only six. So, no. Trois is a really fascinating dice as a worker's game. It is almost perfect on so many levels. And I'm saying this after only one play. I need to get more plays of this before, of course, we can review it. Because, you know, we here on Get On Board like to get five plays in before we recommend a game. But I already see the potential of this game maybe firing, and this is hard for me to say. You have no idea how hard it is for me to say this. Maybe firing Marco Polo for me.
I'm pumped to fire Marco Polo. Let's do it. Don't like that game.
It has this wonderful interaction where you roll the dice as workers, but then you can steal the dice from other players, but you have to pay them for them. So making it possible for them to steal dice from other players or maybe to do other things that require cash. And it has a really this really interesting idea of an influence track. And at first it looks like the victory point track because it sort of is, you know, going around the top edge of the board. Right. And you think, oh, that's clearly the victory points. No, all the influences is a commodity. I don't think it's worth anything at the end of the game unless I played it wrong, but I don't think it converts to anything at the end of the game. The victory points are given to you kind of chip style, like in Puerto Rico or in Small World.
Interesting.
But the influence is used to manipulate your dice during the game. You can spend four influence to flip three of your dice to the opposite side. And you can buy workers buy additional workers for two influence. So you have to manage like your money. You have to manage sort of this influence economy. There are all these events that come out that you're trying to think, okay, do I want to really fight out this event to keep the bad thing from happening again next time? Or, yeah, that bad thing happens to me, but it's hurting other players worse than it's hurting me.
Right.
So do I give them the opportunity to fight it? But of course they get victory points if they fight that event off. So there are so many trade-offs. This has a lot of decision, but it doesn't feel nearly as point salad-y as like a Felda does, which, by the way, I don't have a problem with, but some at this table don't seem to like.
Yeah, Jerry. He means me.
Yeah. So, but there's a lot of depth to this game, and there's a lot more interaction than there is in most Euro games.
Now you're speaking my language.
You can.
Now you're selling the game.
Okay. There's not as much interaction as there is like in a Tammany Hall.
Yeah, that's okay. I can't handle Tammany Hall all the time.
It's not that kind of interaction. It's your engine building kind of Euro with just a little slice of meanness to it.
It's a Lancaster interaction.
Yeah.
Okay.
Not even as mean as Lancaster, but it still has enough of that.
Yeah.
That, I mean, every time you roll those dice, you're thinking, oh, great, I rolled a 6. Oh, no, he's going to try to steal that from me. So do I try to use it first? But it's a 6 yellow, but I really need to do the red action first, because if I don't do that, somebody else is going to do it. So it's got a lot of that really tense stuff. You're in each other's business.
Interesting.
And so I'm really looking forward to this one, to playing it more. I know that it's probably a foregone conclusion, probably, that people think will recommend this, because it is such a highly recommended game on so many levels. I don't know where it ranks in Board Game Geek, but I think it ranks pretty high.
Yeah, I'm a tougher sell than Tim. We'll see.
Yeah,
I haven't played it yet.
We'll see on this one.
Yeah.
And offhand, I'd say the one thing that it does better than Marco Polo. Marco Polo has these really wild cards, action cards that you can use, but they're placed at different locations on the map. So if you haven't traveled to those locations, or if the path that your bonuses drive you toward don't have you traveling in that direction, you're kind of stuck.
Right.
And you can get in a situation where one player is milling all that on his own, and there's really not much you can do about it. And there's no traveling. It's all right there.
Yeah.
So if there's a really powerful combo, you all have equal access to it, and you're all going to fight for it.
Right.
So, I think the game has a lot of really good potential.
All right. Well, I think that wraps up our show for this week.
We thank you for listening to Get On Board. We urge you not to think of all the other things you could have done with the last hour of your life.
Learn to knit.
You can look us up on
www.getonboard.games. You can also find us on iTunes and Google Play Music. You can find us on Board Game Geek under Get On Board, or under my personal username of AJ94. Or Tim's personal username of
Board Game Greek. Get it?
Because he's Greek.
You can also find us somewhere in the Kansas City area if you're really lucky, but you won't know it's us. Because we don't wear name tags.
Only on Thursdays.
Bye.
Two guys that love board gaming and are blah, 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 blah. Let's do this all over again.